Okay, we were in the midst of paragraph 78, and I detoured into the preface, paragraphs 28, 29. And the two thoughts in paragraphs 28, 29 I wanted to bring out, one on the bottom of page 16, when Hegel says, in this respective formative education, regarded from the side of the individual, consists in his acquiring what thus lies at hand, devouring his inorganic nature, and taking possession of it for himself. So the process of the education, which is going to be the reading of the book, is going to be catching up with our own inorganic nature, that is, the history that is already sedimented in us. And if I can use a Husserlian phrase here, this would be a reactivating of the origin. You think of that great account in The Origin of Geometry, where he says, you know, what lies behind 2 plus 3 equals 4? And he goes all the way back to the Greeks and walking fields and things like that. Well, similarly, there's this idea that, to use Gadamer's phrase, we are more being than consciousness. That's what he means by our inorganic nature. We are more being than consciousness. And the way in which we're more being is all that history is simply sedimented in us and comes out as our capacity to do the simplest sorts of things. For example, we simply know without problematic thinking about it, that the Earth revolves around the Sun. Although none of us have actually seen that, we actually always see the opposite. We always see the Sun, right? But we've got that. We don't need the whole history of the controversies. So far, that what took people centuries to discover, what people went to jail for, what they were killed for, we have as a bit of common sense knowledge. And the common sense knowledge is the tip of the iceberg. That's what Gadamer means by we are more being than consciousness. And we have to take possession of that history. So Hegel says at the end of paragraph 29, turning this now into Hegelese jargon, it is no longer existence in the form of being in itself, neither still in the original form of an abstract concept nor submerged in existence, but now is now the recollected in itself, ready for conversion into the form of being for self. How this is done, we shall come to. So it's a recollected in itself that is to be made, brought to consciousness. So when he says in paragraph 78, going back to it, that the series of configurations which consciousness goes through along this road is in reality the detailed history of the education of consciousness itself from the standpoint of science. It means we are now going to watch natural consciousness going through this educative process. An educative process that is manifest in us, right, via its being our inorganic nature. Now, part of what makes this education possible, Hegel says, toward the end of that paragraph, is that he is going to have a, as we've already been told, a skeptical method. And he says, the skepticism that is directed against the whole range of phenomenal consciousness, on the other hand, renders the spirit for the first time competent to examine what truth is. So he's going to be claiming that he's got a skeptical method that's deeper, darker, more dangerous, more thorough than Descartes. But he's referring to the skeptical method, he's referring to Montaigne, to Descartes, and he is himself going to be employing a skeptical method. But he says a skeptical method that is going to go against the whole range of phenomenal consciousness. And because it does so, and here he, as it were, gets down and dirty, it brings about a state of despair about all the so-called natural ideas, thoughts, opinions, regardless of whether they are called one's own or someone else's, ideas with which the consciousness that sets about the examination of truth straight away is still filled with and hampered, so that it is, in fact, incapable of carrying out what it wants to undertake. He's here going right back to the beginning of the introduction, in which he had already shown himself skeptical about modern skeptical methods. And we discovered last time that he was skeptical about modern skeptical methods because they were not serious enough. And the reason why they're not serious enough is because they always presume a point of safety and security, namely consciousness itself. Whether it is the cogito, the exemplar of the moment of absolute security or safety, or all the empiricists. I'm immediately aware of impressions. I'm immediately aware of ideas in the mind. I'm immediately aware, and this goes right through the French encyclopedists, right? No one in the 17th or 18th century ever thought to question the transparency of ideas before the mind. That was a given. And Hegel says, if you help yourself to that, then you can't be serious. Because what we need to question is what it means to have, for example, an idea in the mind. So it's at this point where Hegel is thinking of the model of ancient skepticism as opposed to modern skepticism. And again, just to remind you, ancient skepticism was the practice of trying to show that of two opinions, each was equally plausible and implausible, and that to show that no side of a serious debate about a problem of knowledge could be shown to be true. So ancient skepticism had the method of equipollence, is what it's called, the method of trying to find a balance of we nowadays call it a balance of terror on each side of the debate. And of course, for them, but not for Hegel, this was actually part of an ethical exercise. Because for them, the idea was, if you learn that you could not have the truth, that there was always good reasons to believe and not to believe, then the right thing to do would be to suspend belief. If you could suspend belief, you could reach a point of equilibrium, what they call ataraxia, which is a state of calmness and acceptance of the world because there was no truth to be had about it. Hegel wrote on this. Michael Foster's written a whole book about Hegel on skepticism, giving an account of his own writings, so that Hegel was clearly aware, Forster's made the argument, small man with a small mind, but he's made his thought absolutely indubitable. I like his book on the idea of phenomenology. And there's no doubt that he had this view of ancient skepticism in view. So he wanted, and this is what lies behind his search here, to find a method of skepticism that would avoid the traps of modern skeptical methods, right, of which the paradigm is the first meditation. I doubt, you know, you give the reasons for doubt and going all the way back to the evil demon. Skeptical method, trying to show you're assuming or presupposing nothing. What Hegel wants is a general skeptical method. And hence he wants to have a method in which he throws doubt over everything. And therefore nothing is taken for granted within this method. Having that thought is what leads people to think that Hegel has a presupposition, the starting point, which I will refute in about 17 minutes. Nonetheless, it's a skeptical method. So how is his skeptical method going to differ in the first instance from the Cartesian empiricist skeptical method? And the answer is given in the next paragraph, when he wants to say that we're going to be doubting, we already know, forms of consciousness, whatever forms of consciousness means. We don't know that yet, but he's used that phrase. We're doubting natural consciousness, let's call it natural consciousness for the moment, and we're going to doubt all the different forms of natural consciousness as they arise. And he says that this series of skeptical doubts, each doubt will bring us to a moment of despair. If you hold any of these views, you will find yourself in despair. That the series of this will be a progression, a narrative of a kind, an interconnection. And he says, and again, this is again very Cartesian, by following every falsity, this is false, 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 we'll bump into the truth. When there's nothing left, or we can't negate anymore, that it will bring us to that moment of truth. So he does take, so this is a kind of via negativa, but not quite, the reasons we'll come to, because it's also a bildung. And that will be the double-sidedness of it, both a wholly negative process and a bildung at the same time. And therefore, there better be at least two points of view from which we tell this story. If we're going to have nothing but skepticism all the time and education all the time. So you already know there are going to be at least two points of view. Right? And that the story will have to be double-voiced. And there has to be not only double-voiced, but for reasons that every reader of the modern novel understands, namely the biographical form, precipitation, or biographical form. After that, you'll have to be triple-voiced. So, it's going to be a negative progression, a series, that will bring to pass the completion of the series. That's the hope. And of course, he expects us to have in mind, as he says this, either, and he doesn't care, right? You can think either Cartesianly, you're going to get to something, or you can think negative theology, you're going to get to something, but he's thinking that we're used to this idea that the negative can take us this way. Now, he now gives it an extra twist. He says, well, our forms, our form of pathology, which I may mentioned last week, is of a particular kind. Namely, what makes us pathological creatures is our one-sidedness. Remember my claim last week that the pathologies of modernity are a series of one-sidedness that could not be reconciled. So, mind versus body, man versus nature, individual versus society, faith versus reason. Right on down the line, we have these series of dualisms, and it's the irreconcilability of those dualisms that generates the crises of modernity. But because we are alive, and none of us are ancient skeptics, none of us are capable of ataraxia, we are bound to one side or the other. So we are either, to use a famous phrase, dogmatists or skeptics. That is, we are either someone who feels, no, I know it's only, but I'm going to go with the revolution and the terror. That's Fichte did, right? Jacobin to the end. Or the problem of skepticism. So the one side is, so the skepticism is going to be of a peculiar kind. The skepticism is going to have to show that what's wrong with the forms of natural consciousness is their one-sidedness, which means that one-sidedness is always taking a partial truth for the whole. That is the mistake for Hegel, is the substitution of the part for the whole. After all, he's the guy who said the true is the whole. So he's bound to say, going backwards, that the form of pathology is the taking of the part for the whole. That's what every position you will find, will come across, will be doing. That is, reifying a partial truth so that it becomes the whole truth, which is to say that every previous philosophical position is a caricature. Right? It exaggerates a half-truth and makes it everything, which is why, again, philosophy is inherently comical. That is, there's something laughable about philosophical thought. If you don't giggle when you read Berkeley, you're not reading the same book I'm reading. Which isn't to say, read Branka Arsic's great, great, great book on Berkeley, that Berkeley is one of the darkest thinkers of the modern epoch. Arsic's book is devastating, about the notion of passivity and exhaustion. It's the most best reading of Berkeley ever, I think. But it's also, again, as Arsic would know as well as anyone, comical. And this book is in part the reversals. As you will see, have one of the reasons I like Hegel is for a German philosopher, he has a sense of humor. Notion of reversal is common. Okay, so the notion of skepticism is to overcome one-sidedness. So the skepticism is a skepticism of overcoming positions, but the suspicions of themselves are going to be reification of one-sided views until we overcome those. And we are not tempted by such one-sidedness again. That's the first thing he wants to aim at. The second thing he now says is that the via negativa is not a via negativa, because the issuing of a skeptical doubt . For example, just saying that a particular theory is false because it's contradictory. I want to be clear. In logic, a contradiction entails what? Someone's here taking a logic exam. What?
Nothing follows.
Anything follows! Right? The problem with contradictions, right, is that if I'm saying, the tree is green, the tree is not green, I'm entitled to say the frog is purple. It's bad news, right? Now, the notion was is that contradiction can't get us anywhere. Therefore, if we're discovering internal contradictions, impositions, part of a skeptical method, then we're just going to end up each time with nothing. Right? Now, that is a truth of logic. So when Hegel here now suggests that he has a different view in mind, he's saying that he is no longer following the rules of formal logic, either as it was he inherited it from Aristotle, or that it now exists in Phrygian form. Because he says that the negation of a position, the discovery of a contradiction, yields a, and it sounds now, if you're a logician, like an oxymoron, a determinate nothingness. Determinate nothingness. Now, in this, and a determinate nothingness which has a content. So he claims that this is the theory of determinate negation. And I'll be giving details of it in a second. But the intuitive thought here is in fact that Hegel is operating much, much more like an ordinary scientist than like a logician. For a scientist, when they test out a theory and it gets refuted by the evidence, so it has a prediction, I predict X, and shown hold not X, so I've got a contradiction, X not X, they don't think, oh, I've got nothing, right? They say, wait a minute, there must be a mistake in the theory. Why did we go wrong? Let's cook up a new theory to explain why this one went wrong, and that will account for the facts we missed. In the first person to try to think this in, it can be formalized, but the way in which pragmatism, Charles Sanders Peirce, who was an Hegelian, at least for a moment, thought of it, came with the idea of abductive inference. Which is a typical Peircean unreadable phrase. So everyone else uses a much nicer phraseology. Inference to the best explanation. Hegel's thought, and I'll say it in a minute how, a little bit how it's Hegel's thought is, and this is why I think for years, certainly throughout the 60s and 70s, if you wanted to beat up on Hegel, the first place you went was the idea of determinate negation. Because it was just clear he was a bad logician. Namely, he was tolerating contradictions, and he said they went somewhere, right? And it just, you know, it just gave people who went to Oxford reasons better to be Hegel. And this was the reason why. Determinate negation was the reason why. Now, my suggestion is the notion of determinate negation is actually part of a standard empirical method. Once we are no longer naive about how science works and how theories work, and how as thinkers we try to develop explanatory accounts of experience, at any level, at any kind of science, we're always going to be fixing things up, and that is we're going to take it that refutations are a spur to generate a new version of our theory. And the new version of our theory will always have the minimum capacities to explain what the former position could not explain, and do so on the basis of pointing to what its weakness was. So it can't be ad hoc. So the debate here now would be the question of whether these acts of determinate negation, Hegel does talk a lot about necessity. And the question is, what kind of, so this is the necessity of transition, right? To move from one form of natural consciousness to another. And Hegel seems to claim at various moments that the movement forward is some form of necessity. If I'm right in thinking that it's inference to the best explanation, it won't be necessary. But let me say a word about this. At least one plausible account, there are varieties. In Foster's book on the idea of phenomenology, he gives a fairly detailed account on page 186. I'm going to go for a shorter account in Pippin on page 108. Some theory A that failed, and we want to understand the status of B, which is going to be the successor theory. So since you've all been reading a little bit ahead, I assume, this is sense certainty, this is perception. What makes perception follow from sense certainty? At the very least, and here would be the strongest version, Pippin says, is to argue that given the internal difficulties of A, B is the only possible resolution of those difficulties, and so represents a necessary correction to A. So B is the only possible. Why may you not want to argue that?
Those of you who've done sentimental logic, it's a fallacy for denying the
well, but how about the only possible? Of course, it's not a logical inference. We know that. That's why he calls it abductive. We know it's not a logical inference. It would be for him in the end. But why is this going to be, even on its own terms, impossible? Be strong. Yeah?
You've got to go through and demonstrate what each and every possible... Yeah. And, I mean, it's like proving something doesn't exist.
Exactly, right. It's proving an existential negative, which is really hard to do. Do you follow that? You've got to prove that there... You know, it's not that there is a counterexample that you have to show. You have to show that there can be no possible counterexample to it. So you have to prove a negative existential. And that turns out... That's an impossibly strong criterion. So that cannot be, and that's the only way, by the way, I want to be clear about this, that an abductive inference could be necessary. So whatever Hegel means by necessary, it better not be that. Okay, I'm glad I'm having fun here, no one else is. Do this for years, you find various things amusing. So, a weaker version of the argument, I mean, this is a graduate course on undergraduate, so I'm going to get this stuff right. The weaker version is to say that B does resolve the inadequacies of A in the appropriate way and issues a challenge to any potential objector to provide a better resolution. So, not that B is the only possible, but simply that B does do the work of accounting for it. And I'm going to actually add another counter. Not only that B does that, but in each and every case we will discover that B is an available historical position. So what Hegel's roughly claiming is that for every successor form of consciousness, he's looking for an account that does follow, does explain the failures of the earlier one, and is one we actually already have in our repertoire of positions that people have held about these matters. It then follows, of course, so these really are inferences, in my case, these are inferences of this explanation under conditions of historical provinciality. Or, so going forward, I want to be absolutely clear, there is no necessity. Just like going forward, there is no necessity in any narrative. The necessity, when it arises, will arise from the end point, and lo and behold, the next paragraph, that's what Hegel says. That is, if you think of a narrative, the necessity will have to be retrospective necessity. So, I'll explain why, but as my friend Julian Rose used to say, going forward, the phenomenology is a gamble, and retrospectively, it's a necessity. Why necessary? Because when we get to the end point, and then we have to know that there can be an end point, what that end point is, but if we can reach an end, then the path from A to B to C to D to the end shows that it was, those were the moves we needed to make in order to get here. So like any narrative story, we have to show the steps by which we can get to the end. Well, what would be the end? Minimally. Not what he says. What would be the end minimally? A kind of naive, let's call it a naive Proustian sense. How, what's the minimal condition for this book ending? It has to make possible that it was written at all. So this is an education of consciousness to the point of view. So this is a portrait of the artist as a young consciousness. Proustian, I mean, that's why I have students in Boston working on Proust, Hegel, PhDs. It's one of those obvious kind of topics. Why? Because the end of the book must be the conditions of it being written at all. So consciousness reaching the standpoint of what he calls absolute knowing, right? The goal. But the goal will be now that you can see how you got to the position whereby you could overview this whole process and see yourself as the result of it and see that going through this process is what allowed you to write this book. So, in that sense, the book is nothing but a historical recapitulation of its own conditions of possibility. So, yeah, it has to go back to the beginning in exactly that sense.
Yes? So, I get it right. You want to say these conditions of possibility are themselves historical?
Absolutely. Well, but that has to be discovered. And that will give us a problem with, again, perspectives and standpoints and all of that. It will turn out that although we're going to start with natural consciousness, which is that we're going to start with, let's call it egoology. We're going to start with the view that there are individuals who face a world. We're going to discover, as we already know from spiritual Christianity, that's not true. That individuals don't just face a world. Individuals are parts of historical communities. And therefore, the story is going to have to run consciousness discovering that it is not the measure of all things, that spirit is the measure of all things, and then spirit has to go through a history to get to the point where spirit is the kind of spirit that allows, oh, people like Mr. Hegel to write that kind of philosophy book. So this is going to be a spiraling story of where, and in this sense, maybe more like a Virginia Woolf novel than Proust, in the sense that there's going to be masquerade, right? That you're going to start with someone who looks like a consciousness and looks like a man, and then it's going to become an 18th century scientist, and then it's going to become a woman in Greece, and then it's going to become the characters are going to change. And the very meaning of what it is to be a character are going to change. Right? So it's going to be rich in that way. That's not exactly what he says the meaning of paragraph 80. He says something much more modest, but the modesty for me is terribly important. Because what he gives is a formal and not substantive account of ending. Right? But the goal is as necessarily fixed for knowledge as the serial progression. It is the point where knowledge no longer needs to go beyond itself, where knowledge finds itself, where notion corresponds to object and object to notion. So, you don't know what that means yet. But at some point, it's where whatever natural consciousness is supposing about the world at that point, it turns out it works out okay. And therefore, there's no unfulfilled desires, there's no further negations to make. You can just relax. Okay. So not unlike ataraxia in that way. You've kind of, you've got your desires satisfied. However, short of that moment, life is hell. That's what he goes on to say. Because and this is something we don't have an understanding of, and it will actually be weeks before we get a rich enough conception of consciousness to understand it fully. But he says that the progress is unhalting until we get there because no satisfaction is to be found at any of the stations on the way. That is, he's given you a standard correspondence theory of truth. We can stop when object corresponds to notion and notion to object, whatever that means. That sounds like correspondence theory of truth. And then he suddenly adds a wholly affective erotic dimension. Namely, that prior to that moment when that formal criteria is satisfied, there'll be no satisfaction subjectively. That is, there will be a restlessness of consciousness, so that consciousness itself will be tearing itself to pieces, forcing itself to go on. And then he says, well, of course, there are various ways, forms of self-deception that allow you to stop, but eventually they will collapse too, and you will be forced to go on. So he presumes that this forward motion now is both, let's call it, logical and erotic. where the notion of a quest would be one version of an erotic pursuit. The other might be the ascent. The Republic as an erotic pursuit, Symposium, those models. But he's certainly suggesting that knowledge has something to do with desire, and what we're looking for is a certain kind of satisfaction, and that's going to have something to do with the picture of subjectivity at stake here. That is, to get the right kind of account is also going to be the kind of account that provides us as modern subjects with the kind of self-understanding that means we are, remember our starting point, no longer in crisis, no longer feeling alienated from our world, no longer torn to pieces. And we'll see that various forms of consciousness are literally described as torn to pieces in various ways. Or to put it another way, we will not be compelled to participate in any further self-defeating performances, because all previous forms of natural consciousness will be forms of self-defeating performances. That's what those structures will be. Okay. Deep breath. Are there any questions there? Because, as it were, Hegel starts the whole thing all over again in paragraph 81. He does the same analysis at the level. He's now done it at the level of consciousness. He now does it at the level of self-consciousness. So it's a kind of double movement introduction. We all on the same page up to here have some idea of how this is supposed to work itself out.
I'm sure we'll get to it, but maybe you can just throw forward and let me ask, what allows the various moments to actually be articulate and distinct from each other? So that each failure is actually a distinct failure and right as well as a progression. As opposed to the repeating of the same kind of failure. If that makes sense. Like, how do we know that we're actually making progress when we go from A to B?
Oh, no, that's not the question. You want a better question. No. The question from A to B I already answered, right? B will be progress over A just in case it resolves the contradictions in A and does so on the basis of giving us insight into the mistakes in A. So getting from A to B is easy. The question that arises, what you said is rightly the question of progress, right, is whether these are transitive. Right? This is the big problem with historical theories of natural science. Right? You can, the question, what do I mean by that? Is it transitive?
Is C is much better than A as B was?
Exactly. So you know that B is better than A, and C is better than B, but does it follow from that that C is better than A? Because unless C is better than A, then you're not making progress, you're just kind of going through bumps, right? And this was the great anxiety that arose when historical accounts of physics first arose, the Kuhnian, Lakatos, Virov, Endian accounts, right? And what do you suppose Hegel's answer is going to be, given what I've just said? How does Hegel get transitivity into the story?
He's getting to the end.
You ain't going to get there until the end. So your question is exactly right, which is why I said, up until the end, it's a gamble. At any moment, you may, you know, that failure is possible. And that the method has to allow for this. Transitivity is not built into the overall structure of the account. That is, he doesn't give transitive accounts. Although there are I want to say mini compensations for the absence of transitivity. Namely, you will feel at certain moments, which is why people stop reading the book at various moments, as if you've reached an end. And there's a way in which the parts sometimes feel bigger than the whole in reading this text, because they feel like real microcosms of the whole, and in a way they are. So that I want to say, and this, by the way, is, I'm just reading for the first time, so I can't tell you how good the whole book is. But the first 25 pages is pretty good. John Russell is reading Hegel's Phenomenology. I'll bring it up occasionally because I haven't read it before. It's the only commentary I haven't read, so I'm reading it. And Russell has the thought that you can read the book in a way happily non-cumulatively by thinking about how each section has a kind of microcosm structure, microcosm-macrocosm structure. And he's not implausible. So that part of the satisfactions is you feel like you know what the end is going to be before you get there, because it's so heavily adumbrated in various ways by the nature of the individual failures. But I want to say that that's a fool's paradise. It's true, but it is a fool's paradise. The real notion of transitivity is because of the end. Right? So if Hegel couldn't write the book or couldn't complete the book, right? I mean, think what an odd book Remembrance of Things would be if it ended just with writer's block. We really wouldn't know how to read it either. I mean, it would be very odd. Right? So that something about that structure of that book, right, has about it a certain type of necessity, given the very nature of the question it's on. Right? That is, we know very, very early on that this is a portrait of how Marcel becomes a writer. Right? All the things are there, right. Right away, Swan's Way, and the story with the musician. Anyway,
he heard the melody by Bantoy.
Bantoy, thank you. I'm glad someone's literate here, not me. So the Bantoy theme, we already know that what this is going to be about from that. Right? Well, same here. We kind of know. Kind of, although again, the surprises are pretty stern, and Hegel's readers would not have known where he was going to end up at all. They're in for big surprises in ways I'll explain. So transitivity, the notion where it's really progressive, not till the end. Only the end gives it back the necessity. Roxy?
I agree with the end giving it necessity, but as for transitivity, couldn't one say that, I mean, Hegel puts a lot of effort into giving the appearance that everything is already there from the beginning, and therefore once you reach the end, it seems like a necessary progression, but he works a lot on giving you those little steps and realizing, it was already there, we've already had that. Couldn't the transitivity at least somewhat follow from that? Not in the sense of value necessarily, but in the sense of transition, not necessity either.
Except that, two things. He's actually, say, as we know this book is, it's a memory book. Okay, it's a remembrance of philosophy past. It's going to be a bit of a memory book. So, given the sort of inorganic nature, it's already here. So in some way, he does want to claim it's making the implicit explicit. He is going to claim it's drawing things out. All those are right metaphors, except they don't account for the logical character of the book. The logical character of the book still has to come up to this criteria, or it fails. So no matter, so even if I don't remember ever being in the spiritual animal kingdom, that's not important. It's got to have a certain logical character, and I've got to be able to consider it in a certain, as having a certain historical pedigree. So the criteria turn out to be those are ways of trying to get you to think about the process as a seduction in the preface, but he needs this. Yeah, Adam?
I guess I'm wondering about even characterizing the end in it, because the criteria you gave us is that it can make sense of the fact that it is, how it came about. So it has to be able to account for the standards that make sense to it in light of everything that came before.
Right.
But I guess my thought is, I was late, and I could give you a whole narrative about why I was late. Because, you know, I was at the airport, and there was all these things happening. But couldn't I give you several different narratives about how I got here, and according to the kind of narrative necessity we're talking about? And, of course, once I got on the express bus, and, you know, the driver was a little slow, then, you know, it follows that I'm going to be late. However, I could have taken the air train, and...
So, this is the cost. Now, here's the way to answer. I mean, that's absolutely what you say is true. And that's the cost of dropping necessity, only possible, and going with not a necessary but a sufficient explanation. So what that does, however, is although it generates necessity, it doesn't give it the character of logical indefeasibility. What it does, and what it must do, is there are, it turns out there's some further criteria. It must account for all the standard philosophical prejudices of all the members of its philosophical audience, and it must give all of them reasons to move from their partial perspective to a fuller perspective. So it has to address its audience. And if it can do that, and if it can satisfy all these criteria, then, again, still not logically feasible, what it has done is simply issued a massive onus probandi. That's all you can do. Speak Latin. I mean, all you can do is show that now all the weight is on someone else who wants to argue differently. That you have nothing further you need to do for your position. If someone wants to come up with another position, they've got to show why your account fails their perspective. So that becomes then the standard Hegelian score. Kierkegaard says, no, I'm not in there. And us, you know, Hegelians say, oh, yes, you are. You're right here. Right in there. There you are. Unhappy consciousness. You're done. Next. And that, but that is what it's, I mean, Ethel, that's, so you're right, it doesn't have the character of a rationalist system, and it cannot have the character of a full-scale rationalist system, precisely because, right, its acceptance of the inevitability of contingency. Sure. Right? The necessity of contingency means that it can never attain the status of logical indefeasibility, and therefore can't even do a transcendental deduction. Why I don't like even the thought that he was attempting to do a transcendental deduction, because that makes no sense of the role of contingency in the argument.
But just
for
the claim about, I mean, I guess this is where I want to tie your talk about logical indefeasibility and satisfaction. Because what's great about the end is that we're finally satisfied in some fundamental way, right? So when you mean no, that there's no logical indefeasibility, you mean no finality. That it's perfectly possible someone else could come along and say, look, the standards you just reconstructed don't make any sense at all, and here's why. And so, you know, you're back in the fray again. So I guess that's the worry, that, I mean...
But I'm saying that part of the satisfaction will be learned to discover that that's not let's call it, what does Putnam call that? It's the skeptical induction, right? That every theory, and the skeptical induction, Putnam says, is we know from the past that every theory has been proved false, therefore we know that every future theory will be false. Even if that's logically true, which it is, I want to suggest, or I'll try to convince you, that Hegel gives us reasons to think that that kind of objection should not disturb us. That that's the wrong level and the wrong kind of skeptical doubt. That kind of skeptical doubt, so the capacity to feel satisfaction in the Hegelian sense, is also learning about what I said in the very first lecture, is the disappointment of knowledge. That knowledge doesn't provide all the forms of security or defense or certainty that many people have thought knowledge did. And knowing that is part of what absolute knowing is. That is, knowing about knowledge is knowing what knowledge can't do. Right? I mean, isn't that the story of, like, 90,000 Hollywood movies? I know exactly what it is to find the perfect wife. You know, and of course, I fail miserably, right? Because knowledge and practice fall apart. I mean, we all know that there's certain things that the thought of what knowledge can do is illusory. And this book begins, I want to say, with certain framing of the limits of knowledge, and it's going to turn out the framing is going to be very powerful, because it turns out that we're not essentially knowers. So absolute knowing is the knowledge of us as non-knowers, namely as historical agents in complex social worlds who live in accordance with complicated, you know, communal norms and so forth. So, you know, it's not going to be that knowledge. So our knowledge of ourselves, we need knowledge about ourselves as essentially non-knowers. So these are absolutely the right kinds of questions we should be, you know, kind of feeling. I mean, to feel that, yeah.
Does this then allow for the possibility that we could get to the end through a different series of solutions?
Yeah. If you think some fundamental moment is missing, there's something wrong about science or nature or history or politics, or maybe you think he can't reach the end, or maybe you think reaching the end doesn't leave him where it thinks he leaves him. There's all sorts of possibilities. And those, I really want to say, has to do with the kind of demonstration it is. So I want to insist upon that kind of, that level of openness. Okay, we've already gone an hour and I have not yet begun. That's always dangerous. And I do want to finish the introduction today. So let's have a 10-minute break. And then I'm going to go right through the method itself. By now, it will turn out to be much easier because we've got a lot of stuff already going.